This is A-State Connections on KASU. I'm Jonathan Reeves. This is the weekly segment called A-State Connections and Create at State, making connections that count. In this segment, we go back to the Create at State Virtual Symposium in April to hear research from the College of Liberal Arts and Communication. First is Heather Cooper with her presentation, Coercive Control Inside Mentally Abusive Relationships.
Coercive control is a subtype of domestic violence that often goes unnoticed, but it can leave more long-term damage than any violent act in itself. Coercive control can be summed up using what I call red flags. These red flags include jealousy, possessiveness, isolation from friends and family, extreme finance control, verbal put-downs, prevention from work and school. Many times these victims are brainwashed into thinking that this is normal and this is okay and this is what they're supposed to do. So they stay for years and years with their abusers. They also may be harassed by stalking or phone calls or calls to Child Protective Services when they are in fact not the violent offenders their abusers are. I used the theory called FIRO, which stands for Fundamental Interpersonal Relational Orientation Theory. It's by William Schutz. And this theory says that all humans need inclusion, control, and affection. Obviously, if these women are in these bad situations with their children, they don't feel inclusion because they aren't around friends and family. They can't feel included in anything other than with their abuser. They don't have control over their lives. Everything in their life, from their thoughts, their behaviors, their clothing, their way that they parent, is all controlled by their abuser, including their career. They don't have affection because many of times the only affection they receive is from their abuser, and the abuser does this in manipulative ways to gain either sexual advances or ways to keep the victim from leaving them. The method that the court systems use at the moment is the violence model, and this says that these abusers can get a misdemeanor for these things, and past court cases are not brought up if they have done violent acts or harassment acts in the past. With a new model called the coercive control model, past court cases can be brought up. And the United Kingdom has actually already started doing this. And with this new model, evidence from the past can be shown that these abusers have done these things repeatedly and they have a track record, and it will show that they aren't going to change, and it will prove that these women are not crazy and they are not lying, and they and their children really do need help from outside sources. Key findings that I found are that coercive control is a very big issue today. It's an ongoing issue for women and for children, especially in the South, because many times abuse is behind closed doors and other people don't want to get involved, so they turn away. But something needs to be done, and I hope that further research is made on this topic so that women and children in these situations can get help and can have a brighter future. Thank you.
And that was Heather Cooper. Next is Connor Scroggins with his presentation titled Musical Logic or the Language of Uncertain Experience.
When we talk about musical logic, we refer to the organization of musical material. Organization is perceived when we create a focus on specific musical elements, creating a limitation of material and a consistency through that limitation. In this consistency, we perceive a coherent musical idea being conveyed. So how do we create a sense of organization in music. Well, the artistic experience is the same as the human experience. We perceive events and elements of reality and reflect on those experiences. We communicate our ideas drawn from these reflections in both verbal and artistic languages. Thus, coherence in music is a reflection of the organization that we perceive in reality. Just as we present coherent ideas through words, we may construct musical languages that act similarly in reflecting our ideas. So, here's an 18th century example of logic in music. Let's listen to this excerpt from Bach's Fifth Brandenburg Concerto. Notice how we perceive two different consistencies in this excerpt. So, while both sections are clearly apart from each other, they are, in and of themselves, very distinct and unified. Individually, they are very consistent in rhythm, register, instrumentation, and volume. Overall, we perceive one clear idea, and then another clear idea. So, this concerto reflects Bach's culture. This is important. Culture is a culmination of not only our experiences, but also our biases, which are reflections that shape how we experience reality. We are not just guided through experience by sensation alone. Our mind itself also guides in our experience through bias. In this way, the piece by Bach is a culture in and of itself that represents a bias toward experiencing rigidly separate and clearly organized ideas and elements of reality. However, in the human experience, we may also experience a lack of organization. Since musical organization is about reflecting our experiences, musical logic is involved in both organization and chaos. In other words, it is involved with how we build up and break down musical consistencies. In this, we feel an idea more loosely changing. We feel an uncertainty as to exactly what it is. So, in contrast to Bach, let's fast forward to a 20th century composer named Arnold Schoenberg. He was very interested in exploring the potential of musical logic and presenting musical ideas organically. Let's look at the beginning of his Fantasy for Violin and Piano. At first, it may look like a mess, but there's actually some consistencies we can notice. The violin and piano are in disagreement. One sounds, then the other sounds, throwing short little phrases at each other. The violin has upward gestures, whereas the piano has downward gestures. Notice how each time they play a short phrase, they play mutated repetition of something they've played before. They play a more intricate, sophisticated version of their upward or downward gesture. So let's see what we hear with these things in mind. So the overall effect of this passage is that we hear the overall growth of a large idea rather than the individual ideas alone. We hear this passage as one large musical statement built from many smaller ideas, just like letters of a word and words of a sentence. We hear a musical language reflecting on the experience of uncertainty and growth, yet an identity we see from that overall growth. So let's look at a bit of the culmination of my research. Here's a fragment of a piece I've written using ideas of logic. Listen for how I organize ideas and build a consistency on the first page, and then interrupt that consistency on the second page, causing the musical idea to become unstable and gradually change into another idea. Overall, musical logic has taught me how I can build musical languages and understand other musical languages. It also gives an insight into the nature of experience and how we can use the logic of our ever-growing experience of events, objects, ideas, and culture to create things and solve problems in the arts and in many fields spanning beyond the arts in more vividly sharing and refining our human experience. Thank you.
That was Connor Scroggins. Next is Samantha Hostetler with her presentation titled Presidential Inaugural Addresses.
I will begin with an overview of my poster as well as the introduction. The Presidential Inaugural Addresses looks at a collection of 42 inaugural speeches given by the presidents of the United States, beginning with George Washington and ending with Donald Trump. Through the combined use of both text and education data sets that I have collected, some distinctions can be made about the level of writing and speech capabilities in presidents that have a college education versus others that do not. The intentions of my project are to accurately visualize the distinction in education levels of the presidents and the content and diction of their first inaugural address. Moving forward, I first began by collecting where each president graduated from, the level of degree received, and the title of the college degree they received into a single Excel spreadsheet, which you can view here. I then used Cytoscape as a network analysis tool in order to visualize shared college connections of the presidents. Blue represents the university name, while white represents the president name. Red over here represents no college degree held by presidents. From there, I used Tableau as a graphing software in order to visualize the varying and different degrees of the presidents. However, on this graph, you can see that there are more presidents with no degrees that are represented. Moving forward in my project, I used Voyant as a text analysis tool in order to analyze the content and diction of the presidential inaugural addresses. The speeches were collected from Danluce Data Chest Online, as well as the American Presidency Project, and converted into plain text files. I used the Voyant tool's documents and summary in order to create these visualizations. The first two are presidents without a college degree, and the second two are presidents with a college degree. When looking at presidents with a college degree versus those without college degrees, average words per sentence appear to be longer by 75% as opposed to 44% comparing each total average. Additionally, the word count per speech is longer among presidents without college degrees. The vocabulary density among the presidents also varies. More higher-level vocabulary is used among presidents that retain a college degree than those without. There are clear distinctions made between the average words per sentence, average words per document, as well as the vocabulary density in the speeches. In each area, presidents with a college degree have less words per sentence and document and a higher vocabulary density. These are areas that can be characterized by good writing and speech-giving skills, which are not present in presidents that have no college degree. In conclusion, the president's first inaugural addresses and the education levels of the president provides analysis of speech capabilities of presidents with a college degree and those without a college degree. An obvious assumption or argument could be made that the presidents with a college degree would fare better than those without, in which my project does attempt to convey. Some characterization can be made, better writing, such as shorter sentences, more concise writing, better structure, and extensive vocabulary use. In viewing the speeches separately, some sentences are extremely long. For example, President Zachary Taylor has very few periods that end statements in his speech. Other presidents with a college degree, like President Obama, have shorter sentence length, which can be attributed to more structure and concise writing for speech purposes. In comparing the speeches in two groups, college degree and no college degree, this provides a deeper look into the content and diction of speeches written and given by the presidents of the United States. I would like to end with a thank you for my mentor and professor, Dr. Andrea Davis, as well as my classmates in the Digital Humanities program. Thank you.
That was Samantha Hostetler. And finally, Nathan Grimes with his presentation, Traces of a Forgotten City Church.
While doing research for one of my professors by translating the deck section of a 16th century estate inventory, I came across a brief discussion of a Parisian church, the Église Sainte-Croix de la Cité. Upon further research, I found that not only was the structure buried under 19th century changes to Paris, but very few traces of its existence had survived in the scholarship, and it was barely discussed in texts about church architecture in the French capital. However, by using this estate inventory, it is possible to reconstruct a little of this church's history. The document was made in 1533 after the death of Chicard Bailly, a Parisian artisan. Much of it consists of an inventory of items that he owned at the time of his death, which my professor had already translated. I had the opportunity to undertake the translation of the segment dedicated to debts. Mostly dealing with the money that Chicard was owed, it is in items 4 and 7 of this section where mention of this lost church is found. Completed in the 12th century, the church was once situated on Paris's well-known Ile de la Cité. Demolished in 1797, no evidence of the original structure remains. Les Églises Flamboyantes de Paris, by Agnes Bose, a reliable source for information on Parisian churches, only includes a small section on the church. By supplementing the information contained in this book with new discoveries gleaned from the debt section of the estate inventory, it is possible to reconstruct a little more about the story surrounding this missing structure. From Bose, we know that in 1451 and 1454, the church wardens purchased two houses that were situated adjacent to the church. These were demolished and new work commenced, both adding on to and remodeling the original Romanesque church. Work was ongoing in 1499, with the church being consecrated in 1511, though the construction was not completed until 1529. Beyond that sequence of dates, little is known about the project. This is where the estate inventory comes in, however. Item 4 of the inventory, dated January 8, 1522, tells of how Pierre de Fou, Nicolas le Grand, and Guillaume Delamere owed 24 livres tournois to Chicot for reasons that are not specified in the text. A not insignificant sum, what is interesting in this case is that the group owed the sum to Chicot in their capacity as governors of the confraternity of Saint-Hildebert, which we know from the government was founded and headquartered at Sainte-Croix de la Cité. Chicot himself was a member of this group. Item 7 is dated August 26, 1523, over a year later. This time, the governors owe 12 livres tournois to not only Chicot, but also to his son, Jehan Bailly. The question here is, why would the confraternity owe money to its own members? As mentioned in the document, the confraternity of Saint-Hildebert was founded and headquartered at Sainte-Croix-de-la-Cité. This was typical of confraternities, as they were, by definition, an association of laypersons that was approved by the church and was dedicated to performing acts of piety or charity for their community. So, why would the confraternity have owed money to Chicot and his son? A couple possibilities make sense when put into the context of the church reconstruction, since the father and son were owed the money in 1522 and 1523, less than a decade before construction on the building was completed in 1529. First, it is possible that the money owed to Chicot was something that was owed to the other members as well. Members of the confraternity owed regular dues to the organization, so one explanation could be that extra money was requested from each of the members in an effort to fund the remaining construction and then repaid when possible. Or it could have been for a specific part of the construction. Confraternities often had chapels in the churches specific to their organization, and in 1511 we know that three altars had been consecrated, one of them to Saint-Hildebert, the namesake of the confraternity. This suggests a small, separate chapel, which could have been what Chicot and Jehan had put money towards. A second explanation is that the payments was specific to Chicot and Jehan, perhaps for services rendered. As artisans, the two could have had a part in creating some of the ornamentation that became part of the structure, and so could have been paid by the confraternity for doing so. In conclusion, we now know that in 1522 and 1523, the confraternity of Saint-Hildebert, whose governors included Pierre de Fou, Nicolas le Grand, and Guillaume Delamere, owed money to two of its members, Chicot Bailly and his son, Jehan, for unspecified reasons. Those reasons may, however, be linked to the ongoing reconstruction of the church, and therefore could have either been repayment of money borrowed for construction expenses or payment for services rendered to the ornamentation of the new space. Either way, a little more of this lost city church's history has been uncovered, and it is all thanks to what may at first seem an unlikely source, the estate inventory made after the passing of Chicot Bailly.
And that was Nathaniel Grimes. Next week, we'll hear presentations from the College of Nursing and Health Professions as we continue to play the great research that took place during the Created State April Symposium. Created State Podcast is available at iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcast. You can find that new episodes every Thursday. And please tell others about the Created State Podcast. Leave us a review, as we'd love to hear from you. That 5-star review on Apple Podcasts allows us to be able to get this podcast out to more ears. So please give us a 5-star review. You're listening to A-State Connections on KASU.